Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Tuesday, the 9th of April. Coming up on the program, Jacob Zuma's fight to contest the election, the legal complexities, why SAA is looking for a new permanent chief executive, are we getting to grips with our national water leakage problem, and the hard road to success for black accountants. Today we hear in the Electoral Court the case of former President Jacob Zuma and his bid to contest the upcoming May election, all relating to an independent Electoral Commission decision to uphold objections to Zuma's inclusion on the MKP parliamentary list based on his criminal record. I'm joined now by lawyer and commentator Mpumelelo Zikalala. And first of all, on what legal grounds then is the Electoral Commission going to defend its decision, in your opinion, to bar the former president?
Its approach is basically saying, as the Electoral Commission, we are then tasked with sifting or doing the vetting process, which is then going to result in a number of people that are going to form part of the National Assembly. We do not do that in a vacuum. We do that in considering all the applicable legislation, but most importantly, in this case, Section 47 of the Constitution that says who qualifies to be part of the National Assembly. Upon discovery of that there is an objection that has been filed, we then discovered that there's a candidate who have received a conviction of more than 12 months without an option of a fine. Thus, we then took the decision of disqualifying the candidate who is the former president, Mr. Jacob Zuma.
So it sounds like a pretty open and shut case.
It is an open and shut case. However, where the curveball comes in is what happens after the sentence has been reduced by a remission that was issued by the president. So the question that is before the court is, what is the effect of the remission based on the sentence, but most importantly, based on the eligibility of someone that should be able to qualify? Where the IEC, or the arguments which was being heard yesterday, the IEC was stating, make a distinction between a person who is going to issue out the sentence, which is the court, and how the particular sentence is being served. If we stick to the first interpretation, which the IEC is saying, stick to what who issued that decision or issued that particular sentence and ended there, how then the sentence is served has no bearing whatsoever, because the sentence was issued nonetheless and Section 47 is still applicable. Meanwhile, the former president is saying, no, look at those two instances, both of those instances, and then you have a better understanding of where we're going with the effect of the remission, because even if a person is issued out on parole, the sentence is still there, still applicable. It's just that it is served in an alternative manner. However, remission has a different approach because it takes away the number of months that was issued by the court. Yes, someone may say that it's only a court that can issue this type of powers. However, the powers have then been conferred upon the president to say, despite the court having issued this individual with 10 years, you also have the power to remit the 9 years or even the whole sentence so that you end up coming back to zero. So that's the interpretation which will be dealt with by the court today.
It's a very fine point of law that the court is going to have to consider. And if I'm hearing you correctly and understanding, it effectively comes down to the amount of time spent in incarceration.
And the amount of time that should then be received or be considered after the remission has taken place. So basically, the court would be asked to determine, what effect does the remission have? Does it have an effect at all? If it does, then it means that the former president is eligible. If it doesn't, then it means that it only had an effect in how the sentence is being served and nothing else.
Is there precedent for a case like this?
Not at all. There may have been some instances in which the word remission has been discussed, but not in this particular context, which makes this a case, quite a unique one, and certainly which I think the court is going to need to deal with, because there may be other cases that may come up in the near future. So there's no even a legal precedent that you can, which is why you saw lawyers yesterday representing both parties trying very hard to even to look at the simple definition of what the words remission actually means.
Does the outcome of this case then have the potential to impact on future interpretation and application of the two sections of the Constitution that you mentioned, 47 and 88?
Yes, it does, on two bases. The first one, on the eligibility of individuals who are then going to be part and parcel of the National Assembly, because as people go along, they become accused, they become convicted, and they want to contest the elections immediately after. So if there's any remission which is going to be issued out by the president, then only after this case, the president will be very explicit to say, I'm going to apply this remission of issue out this pardon, and this is why I'm doing so, and what effect is it going to have on the remainder of the sentence, or what effect is it going to have on other sentences that have been issued. I think in the proclamation, we are going to find a much more clearer descriptions and the interpretations and the intention of the president with the remission, so that there's no any ambiguity going forward in terms of the effects of the remission, when it is applied or when it has been given by the president.
And just a final one, it would appear to me that Jacob Zuma's legal representative, Dalia Mpofu, is just going in with a big stick approach, saying that the IEC has no power to determine membership of the National Assembly. And he went on to say its attitude towards his client is, and I quote, akin to the apartheid regime denying people their political rights. That argument, is that going to hold any water, do you think?
I do not think so. Remember that the IEC almost acts like a sifting process before a person goes into parliament. So parliament does not hold a separate discretionary process, in a process in which potential members of the National Assembly will have an opportunity to make an application, to file disputes and all those things. And there's no provision that allows that. And it's rightfully so that the interpretation of the IEC is correct, because what you don't want to have is to have 300 members which are going to pass through as potential members of the National Assembly, and yet you find that all of them are not qualified to be members of the National Assembly. The predicament that you're going to have, it means that you have to start the elections again with new entities, with new members, so that you're able to have people that are going to be eligible to sit in those seats. So the IEC is correct in its stance in terms of saying, we are going to be the defenders or the sifters in this particular process. Anyone that wants to be a member of the National Assembly to go through us first. But where they might have erred a bit, but I don't think the court is going to even look into that, because there's not much prejudice that has taken place. It's a situation of saying, if there's a complaint about you, you must be first given the right of reply first before a decision is taken, so that you are able to dispel any lies and correct whatever things and make sure that the person who's taking the decision has got all the facts in front of them. Anything other than that, I think the IEC followed the law in a manner that it should follow it, but most importantly, it was acting within its powers to do so.
Thank you very much for a very comprehensive explanation there. Mpumelelo Zikalala, lawyer, legal commentator, thank you indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South African Airways says it will appoint a permanent chief executive after its deal with the Takatso Consortium as a strategic equity partner collapsed last month. I'm joined now by Derek Hanekom, who's the chair of SAA. Derek, a warm welcome to you. First of all, maybe just explain the timing of this announcement, if you can. Is this a show of no confidence in the interim chief executive?
Hi, Jeremy. Thank you. Not at all. So on the timing on the one hand, and the second question really is whether this is a vote of no confidence. Let's deal with the timing first. There was no rush. This was not a rush decision. We had anticipated the possibility of the deal with the share equity partner, Takatso, not going through. And we knew what needed to be done in that event. Clearly, had the deal gone through, all of these appointments, not only the CEO, the interim CEO and interim COO, rather this the CCO, and various other senior management positions are held on an interim basis. They were appointed on an interim basis. So we were very well aware, as were the affected managers, that Takatso would make up its own mind, would decide itself as the majority shareholder how it wanted to deal with those interim appointments, but we we assumed that they would, they might well want to advertise those positions, but that was the one scenario. The scenario that we're dealing with, and that is with a deal not proceeding, with a deal being terminated, we have to now, immediately we were quite aware that we would have to regularize the positions that were described as interim positions. And the only way we can do that is by advertising the positions and filling them properly through the right process. So it's not only the CEO, it's other positions that are held on an interim basis. By the way, the board itself was described as an interim board. So just in answer to the second part of your question, a vote of no confidence in the CEO, very far from it, very, very far from it. This board that has now been operating for a year, which was not the initial expectation, has worked very, very well with the executive management of SAA. And honestly, Jeremy, we're really impressed with the way they've performed. They have gone beyond the call of duty to get this airline up and running, to recover from a very bad state. And we have done that. We have expressed our appreciation to the existing board members, or rather the existing senior management, and making it also very clear that the advertising of the posts and the obligation that we have to fill these posts properly does not in any way preclude them from applying for these positions. And some of them might well apply for the positions, and they may in fact be the successful applicants. We don't know. But what we do know is that, and we knew it a while ago, that in the event of the deal not going through, that we would have to fill these interim positions properly through the right process.
Derek Honeycomb, having said that, there were always governance and oversight questions around the chair always being the chief executive. That is not an ideal situation.
Well, not at all. I mean, the chair, there was a period when the chair was the same Professor John Lamola, was both the chair of the board and the interim CEO. But that was corrected some time ago. So the interim CEO, as the case should be, the CEO is an executive director of the board. I chair the board. The CEO and the CFO are both executive directors serving on the board.
Let's talk about the process going forward. How big a blow to SAA was the collapse of this deal? I assume that the airline is still looking for a private partner. So what is the process now?
Okay, well, I mean, it didn't come, to us as a kind of a disaster, because we, thinking about possible scenario, we had anticipated the possibility of it not proceeding. It requires of us to rethink some of our plans, because both the corporate plan that was finalized in the financial year ending March 2023 and the most recent corporate plan built in the expectation of a 3 billion rand cash injection. So that was budgeted for and planned, the plans were done in accordance with that. The scenario that we have now is that, this 3 billion rand cash injection is no more. We have to put it this way, tailor our suit according to the cloth. And so we have to adjust some of our plans, because that billion rand that we were expecting for this financial year is no longer there. The good news, and we've said that for some time, is that, we are cash positive, and without the billion rand coming in the year, this financial year, 24-25, we will still be cash positive even by the end of next financial year without any investment coming in.
But having said that, the Department of Public Enterprises also talking about raising a new form of finances based on the airline's current assets and being explored currently with financial institutions. So you've still got to go out and find money.
Yeah, no, we don't have to go out and find money. It makes sense to go out and find money. We will survive it as a small airline with very much adjusted plans and much slower growth than would be the case if the money were to come in. So at no point did we ever say that we were going to collapse if the money doesn't come in, and we won't collapse. The point is, it does make sense to get additional capital brought in, and then we can proceed with our original plans and even exceed our original plans, depending on how much money comes in and from where.
So what is that new form of raising finances then?
I'll get to that in a second, Jeremy. So that the part of it of finding a potential investor, well, that really lies in the hands of the shareholder. Of course, we would appreciate if it would be of great value if an investor were to come in, but it's not going to happen overnight, and it's not necessarily going to be that easy to find an investor. And the DPE have made it quite clear, and the minister, that at this point they're no longer looking for a majority shareholder. They'd be looking for an investor who would be a minority shareholder, but that is their business. That is the business of the shareholders, to find investment in the company which they hold as majority, as 100% shareholder. The other source of possible capital is obviously loan. So the only two possible sources are investment capital and loan capital. So, loan finance. So we are currently looking at and exploring the possibility of getting loan finance to come in. One thing is for sure, none of our plans are based on any bailout from Treasury, and we don't expect that. It's been made very clear that that will not be forthcoming. So our plans are really based on no capital coming in from any source, in which case we will survive, but we have to slow down the kind of plans that we had. We will continue with the Perth flight next year, or not next year, next month. But some of the other new routes that we had planned on would have to be delayed, and that is the planning that we have to do now, since we don't know for sure that a new investor will be coming in, and we don't know for sure that we'll be able to get loan finance either. But we are certainly trying to get loan finance. Very important as well to try to get some of the money back that is owed to SAA, including the over R1 billion that is sitting with Zimbabwe, that kind of legacy debt that is owed to. But we'll try to get that, and we are trying to get that, and the minister is assisting us in that regard. But the fact of the matter is, we will seek any possible cash injection that we can possibly get, but we are also very confident that we will survive the process with much more modest growth plans, even if no cash injection were to come our way.
I am going to leave it there. Derek Hanekom, Chair of SAA, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
A new benchmarking report says nearly half the country's water is lost due to leaks, which means poor or no maintenance. Is this now all a lost cause? Dr. Risimati Manche is the Deputy Director General at the Department of Water. And first up, Doctor, in your own words, how bad is the problem and why does it still persist?
No, thanks, Jeremy, for having us. Let me say, for the past 13 years, when the department initially published its blue and green drop, there was indications and signs that we are actually going higher and higher in terms of our current water losses. So each and every province has actually been growing, but mostly the urban areas have been dealt much in terms of the losses in the infrastructure. Now, to sum it up, I would say on average, the country now, the non-revenue water, we're sitting at roughly around 45% on average. But remember that non-revenue water has a component of physical losses, and that's where we talk about leaks in pipes, reservoir spillages. Sometimes people leave the fire hydrants opened, or vandalism. So all those losses, they form part of your physical losses. But there's then another sub-component of that non-revenue water, which talks to lack of collection of revenue from customers, low payment rates. Sometimes the bills have got errors that customers are unable to pay. So all those, they constitute to the component of non-revenue water, which as a country is actually quite high.
It's a multi-pronged problem then, as you're outlining. Do you think it's getting worse?
It is basically there are some municipalities that are quite improving, but look, when we benchmark for the past 10 years, one would say yes, it's getting worse because last National Water and Sanitation Master Plan, which was released by the department 2018, 2019, it was talking of the non-revenue water component sitting at around 37%. And now we have just gone over a little over 40%. So basically, the stats scientifically, they show that there's actually an increase thereof. But then, Jeremy, you will be quite aware that we have been citing issues of lack of operation and maintenance in our infrastructure, low investment component in the infrastructure upgrade in terms of your reservoirs, pipe replacement, metering, and so forth. So all these, they contribute to the numbers we are currently dealing with at the moment.
So, if the current trajectory continues, what impact or potential impact could this have on water security?
It will have a huge impact. We might sit in a space where the country, and as you know, Jeremy, we are a water-scarce country. We were ranked amongst the top 30 driest countries in the world. We receive less rain, and the country depend much on surface water, so we need rain. But then, if you look at the water security currently, when it talks to us capturing much of the surface water, the country has done so well, and we need to take note of that. That when it comes to the bulk capacity of our raw water system to capture such, the country has done so well. But the challenge is from the clean treated water that leaves these dams and reservoirs to residents. That is where we are basically losing a lot, and it costs the country much. So, if this trajectory continues, we are going to sit with a situation where every drop that goes into the system to be consumed by the residents will actually be lost during the transmission period. And if this escalates, and you factor in the population dynamics, where people move to urban areas and grow, it means we are going to sit with a huge challenge going forward.
I know that this principally is a local government issue, but have we not reached the point now where it's imperative that the national department becomes more aggressively, more assertively involved?
You're right. It's the time now that the national government needs to step closer. But in our case, since 2021, when Minister Mkhwanazi came into office, I think one of the highlights which the country needs to note is his drive and his success in ensuring that the department does not necessarily sit as a sector leader who sets just the norms and standard and regulate, but also step closer to these municipalities and offering support, where we are also bringing the water boards. We're working with COGTA and the various municipalities. This was long overdue, and he has done quite so well also in unlocking some of the old schemes, ensuring that there's actually coordination between our efforts as well as a local government, because that is basically where the challenge is. You would have known or seen also that local government has been battling, specifically when it comes to skills compatibility. Some of the local municipalities in rural areas, they lose a lot of skills. They don't have that high level of attraction. People move to urban areas, and that gap results in these municipalities battling to service their infrastructure. And as a department, we have moved that step closer to support these municipalities and also encouraging them to also look at other options of getting water service providers to step in and support, even using our water board. So this initiative by the minister is starting to bear fruits in some of the areas in the country.
All right, I'm going to leave it there, Dr. Mangia. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Every year, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants administers something called the Assessment of Professional Competencies. And the latest results are concerning: a pass rate for white candidates, 76%, and the pass rate for black candidates, 39%. I want to talk now to Sedzani Musundwa, who is a registered chartered accountant, has strong views on this issue, and has written and researched about it. First of all, then, what are the primary factors contributing to this disparity?
What I think probably comes from my experience being in an accounting academic for the last 15 years. And I think it actually has to do a lot with everything that happens outside of the classroom. So the socioeconomics, the political state of the country. And yeah, so it's not so much the teaching and learning inside the class, it's so much more the lived experiences of everybody who tries to take on the journey.
And you, within that lived experience, you also talk about experiences of injustice, particularly, I'm assuming, within firms themselves. What's happening there?
So that comes from my research. So not my words, but rather the words of those that I interviewed. A lot of the trainees that I interviewed as part of my PhD speak about unfair work allocation. So they deem themselves to not be getting the same exposure as what their counterparts are getting. It's also the rating system. So ratings for the general person is your performance reviews. So you're doing your work, you're working your guts out, and your performance review comes out, and there's a bit of a shock to the system in terms of what's happened here. So it's a culmination of all of that. And then again, just bringing what happens outside of the actual work environment into the work environment, a lot of my participants spoke about the social conversations. So if we're talking about sport and we're bringing what's happened on weekends into the boardroom, it kind of creates a bit of an imbalance.
When it comes to a disparity as far as work allocation is concerned, what do you mean by that?
So what they've shared with me is, some of them would find themselves sitting idle. Idle meaning when everybody else has gone to work on clients and they're servicing as expected, they're finding themselves sitting and asking, but when is it going to be my turn to go? How come I don't get to work on the same clients everybody else is working on? And yeah, so the colloquial term within the profession is idle. They find themselves more idle than actually working within this time of training, which is what they feel kind of threatens the possible sign-off at the end of articles.
And the suggestion then is that this could lead to a perception of incompetence.
Correct. That is how they felt they are perceived. Like, why else would I be sitting here when I'm actually employed to come and do the job? And so they end up feeling like, okay, what is wrong with me? I arrived with the qualifications I was supposed to arrive with, but when it comes to being deployed and coming to being allocated to jobs, that's not happening.
So what specific measures then should be taken by professional bodies like SAICA, that's the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and big firms themselves? Or are they turning a blind eye to it?
I don't think they're turning a blind eye. So one of the things I noted, even in the article, is that there are forums in place, right? There are transformation forums. The issues are being spoken about. You're trying this measure. I think the best way to put it is where you have so many intersecting factors. While you're fixing one thing, something else is going off the rails. And so it's just creating, unfortunately, a space where if you are at the intersection of all these variables that don't work, the system is almost spitting you out. So the firms are trying. I do quite a bit of work with SAICA as well. Like I'm saying, I'm an academic. There's a lot of interventions we've looked at and put in place. The efforts are there. The efforts are recognized. And so, yeah, the work just needs to keep continuing, I suppose.
But the sense one might get is that the effort might be there, but they're not bearing enough fruit.
That's what it looks like. And hence my study was, okay, so all of us are running around trying to solve the problem. Has anybody asked the people who are at the center of the problem what the issue really is? And hence the culmination of my article, where I actually spoke to the trainees on the ground and got their perspective, of what's happening.
So aside from the pass rate and the disparity that exists there, I'm assuming that another consequence of all of this are people simply giving up and saying, well, I've made a bad choice. This profession is not for me. It's not treating me properly. I'm not going to continue. And the problem is that leads to a shortage of chartered accountants in this country, which then has a knock-on effect on the economy itself or the wider economy.
Correct. That is, so you've got those who are giving up. I think what was most outstanding for me in my research is I deliberately chose to only speak to those who've actually qualified. right, who saw through the challenges and made it to the end. And even though they were qualified, they were still saying they want out. There's no ways they are staying within firms. They're not staying in the industry. And I think there's other research out there, or I know there's a lot of other research out there that shows that your black chartered accountants are not staying in the industry to service, or actually losing them.
Well, that is a very bleak picture that you paint, but thank you very much indeed. And incumbent on us, I think, to talk to some of the big accounting firms as well as SAICA. Thank you so much for talking to me. And just before I leave you, on our online poll yesterday, 400,000 skilled people, we reported, have left South Africa in the past 2 decades. The question was expected, worrying, or is our return rate improving? Over half our respondents say no surprise at that figure. 30% say it is a worry. Today, and relating to my interview with the chair of South African Airways, Derek Hanekom, the search is on now for a permanent new chief executive officer. So is progress being made? Is this all a waste of time, or simply I use another carrier? If you'd like to participate in that, go to MoneyWeb on X, also on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Goodbye to you. Thank you for listening.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.